you want to study dynamics of a system without any quasi-particles. So we can't really rely on the standard methods. That's why we're going to sort of attack this problem using three different approaches. And that's my outline also. So I'm going to start by talking about some perturbative quantum field theory, and then in spiral, I'll talk about some ADS-CFT insights. And then this is sort of the new circle in the game. So we have some recent numerics to compare with in the Bose-Hilbert model. And hopefully these things sort of converge into a physical picture at the end. And these are my collaborators on these different aspects. So our chair, Subir, on ADS-CFT. And on the actual QFT work, this was actually started with Santhil, Priyan Gami, Youngbak Kim, and also with Subir. So in a different context, but that's where it started. I'll talk about that a bit briefly. And this is a recent work by Eric Sorensen from McMaster, which is sitting here. And I also want to acknowledge a lot of discussions with especially Rob Myers, his student AJ Singh, Sunsik, and Shagan. So although we can talk about different correlation functions, in this talk I'll only focus on current correlation functions. So imagine you give me some U1 current, that's a conservation law. And in particular, if you compute this two-point function and take the zero momentum limit of that and divide by frequency or energy, you get what we call the optical conductivity. And that is interesting because you can actually measure that both numerically and in experiments. But in principle, you can sort of think about different correlation functions here, like order parameter squared. The system we have in mind and ultimately want to answer questions about is this Bose-Hilbert model in 2+1 dimension. It's a very canonical system. So you imagine you have bosons on a square lattice which hop with amplitude t, and there's a energy scale that tells you how much they dislike each other. And if they really dislike each other, you have a mod insulator. Imagine you're at commensurate filling of one boson per site. In the opposite limit, you have a superfluid, so they're both condensed. And in between, there's a quantum critical point, which in this case have emergent Lorentz invariants at low energies, and that's our CFT3. And so we want to understand what happens as you turn on finite temperature on this and study correlation functions in that fan. In terms of field theory, this is sort of your standard textbook Mexican hat problem. You have the spontaneous symmetry breaking of an O2 order parameter field. So I don't know why I put this such a big slide, but that's the ON model that we all know and love. So as you change the sign of M squared, you have a Mexican hat, and you know, you sort of have SSB happening. So this will be, and this is important, this is the quartic coupling in the theory. So we can't really tackle the O2 model directly, unless you're really amazing and have some brilliant idea, because the interaction scale grows in the IR. So this problem doesn't have any quasi-particles, so things like quantum Boltzmann approach to compute conductivity are just not reliable. That's why it's good to consider, as a starter, a large n limit, in this case a vector large n limit, because we have a vector model, the O(n) model. So take O2 and extend 2 to n, and then take n to be as large as you wish. When n becomes infinite, you have this non-trivial fixed point. Well, it's free, but it's still non-trivial. And the idea is to look at one of our n corrections to that and sort of flow towards this generic CFT. So for example, the O2 model. And in this case, for conductivity, one can encapsulate this quantum field theory calculation and a quantum Boltzmann equation. And that was done by Damley Sachdev. So this conductivity, what we're looking after, is dimensionless in two dimensions. It's a scaling function of energy or frequency over temperature. Temperature is the only energy scale in this CFT, this thermal CFT, this thermal ensemble. When n is infinite, this is the response function you get for the real part. So that's the real conductivity. There's a delta function at zero frequency, which just tells you that there are no interactions in the system. So there's no possible way they can hope for finite DC conductivity. Then there's a spectral gap. It's a free theory, so that's not so surprising. And eventually, you hit this plateau when you pair produce particles, and you have the ground state conductivity, or t equals zero conductivity in this case. When you turn on 1 over n, this delta function becomes broadened. So the height is of order n, this is of order 1 over n, and you actually preserve spectral weight. Here, you shift this by some order 1 over n correction. And in between, we don't really know what happens. That's where PowerPoint comes in, and you just draw something like that. So it's very hand-wavy. And this obviously has a very strong parametric dependence on n. So it's probably very far from, you know, O2 model or O3 model that are relevant for experiments. So the question is, can we do better than this sort of calculation? And recently, people have looked at matrix large n limits, so like Simcic was talking about. In particular, the idea is to consider a large n limit for an entirely different theory. So it's a supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, gauge theory with SUN gauge group in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And that's sort of believed to be really dual to a string theory in one higher space dimension, and there's a compact space. We won't worry about that today. And the main point is that when n becomes infinite, and the tough coupling is also very large, this theory is essentially collapses to classical gravity. So you can sort of use classical gravity tools to sort of flow to this generic CFT and see maybe that's a better approach than the vector large n limit. And so in terms of connectivity, Subir and company have computed this charge connectivity, for those that know about this, the R-charge connectivity of the super Yang-Mills theory using ADS-FT, and at no point do you use any quasiparticles. So it's just a mess of blue balls, but you somehow manage to compute this because the gravity is free. All right, so now I'll explain how this was done and about our work, recent work. So the idea is, we saw this plot, I guess, you know, it's the fourth time today. So the idea is to look at a gravity in a one higher space dimension. So that's our 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetime. It's a finite T slice, so it's three dimensional. What's important is that the spacetime becomes asymptotically ADS. Here, and the CFT can be taught to be living on the boundary of this ADS region. But we're doing finite temperature stuff, so deep in the IR, so this is the RG scale that was talked about previously. Deep in the IR, there's a black hole or black brain, and this will Hawking radiate energy and essentially heat up that boundary, and we have some sort of thermal CFT. And what's important for us is that the current operators in the CFT, so this J mu, will be dual to a local, so this global symmetry will be dual to a local symmetry in a bulk. So this current operator is dual to a gauge field in the bulk. And what's really amazing is that if you solve an equation of motion, classical on-shell equation of motion for this gauge field, you can actually extract some quantum field theory current correlation functions. And the expression that people use to do that is pretty simple. It's just this. And this expression tells you that if you know how this gauge field approaches the boundary and also its derivative, you essentially can extract this connectivity. So this gauge field obeys some equation of motion. In the case of supersymmetric Yang-Mills, it's very simple, it's just Maxwell. So the bulk action is just F squared. And this G4 is this bulk gauge coupling. And the point is that if you compute the connectivity for that theory, it's pretty boring. It's actually equal to 1 at all frequencies, even a complex plane. Well, it's boring, but interesting at the same time. There's a deep self-duality that lies beneath that, that was realized by Subir and company and Herzog. But we're not very satisfied with that for condensed matter purposes, because obviously getting that is, well, probably not so common. So the idea is to do some effective field theory in a bulk. So you look at, so this is two derivatives. And then the question is, what can we have at four derivatives? And it turns out that, so Rob, Subir, and AJ have argued that this is the most generic term that you need to consider to look at current correlation functions. And this term has C, so C is the traceless part of the Riemann curvature tensor. So you can just think as being as a Riemann, and then you can collapse that with two field strengths. And gamma is this coupling that parameterizes that term. So it turns out that there's a bound on this parameter gamma. So just from sort of self-consistent arguments on the CFT side, you sort of can bound this gamma to be less or equal to 1 over 12. And you can sort of, given some CFT, you can compute this gamma by computing some three-point functions on a CFT side. So this was recently done for the ON model by Devanjan and company and Subir. So let's look at what kind of response function we get at finite gamma. So gamma equals 0 is this sort of self-dual line. When gamma is positive, actually equal to 1 over 12 in this case, you have these ripples. That looks promising. I mean, it looks realistic. I like it. One main feature is that there's a peak at small frequencies. And I'll call that a particle-like response, because you expect that type of behavior for a weakly interacting gas of particles, except that a peak would be much larger, but let me call it particle-like. And when gamma is negative, you get this dip, and so you get a valley at small frequencies, and then I'll call vortex-like. This will become, I guess, clearer a bit later. And I call this a DS peak, DS for Damli-Sajdev, but also for Drude scaling, because we'll see that there's a very close connection to the sort of standard Drude scaling formula for the connectivity. Although there's no disorder in this case. So one very productive way of looking at correlation functions is to look at the complex frequency behavior, so in the complex plane. So in this case, we'll find that, well, we have found that the sigma has a bunch of poles and zeros in a complex plane. And these have been known generically in string theory for, you know, 10, 15 years now. And these are called the quasi-normal modes. I guess you can always almost forget about the word quasi. They're just like normal modes in the sense that, well, so on the CFT side first, these are discrete excitation modes of your thermal CFT. And they essentially replace, morally speaking, your quasi-particles. On the gravity side, they're eigenmodes of your black brain. So that's why the normal mode nomenclature appears here.
Is it quasi because they're damped in some way?
Well, so quasi because they diverge at the actual horizon.
What diverge?
So the mode is not normalizable. I think that's the reason why it's called quasi.
No.
It should be decay because it's like a normal mode in a leaky box.
No, but
it's damped.
Yeah. No, it's damped in a CFT, but as you approach the horizon, it actually diverges because you're in a lower half plane.
So they have to decay at horizon.
In falling, yeah, in falling boundary condition.
The compact part of it, we can just make them decay.
The answer to several questions is yes.
I'm sorry?
because they're not real.
Yeah, so the frequency is complex, yeah. Okay, so there's a sign difference between decaying and exploding, I guess. But but in the CFT, in the physical CFT, they decay. I mean, they correspond to decaying modes. But here, actually, I'm going to just talk about this one slide, because this the first normal mode that was discovered in this connectivity was actually on the CFT side. And this was work with Puyan, Santel, and Youngback. And this was work on the Mott transition of fermions. But in that case, we had to sort of study the ON model of bosons. And what I'm plotting here, that's actually Subira's data. But beneath the data, there's a curve. And that curve is the Drude scaling. And this Drude scaling essentially is a single pole structure of the connectivity. And so this fit is like, you know, as good as you can expect. And this pole, in this case, happens at a frequency of minus I over tau, so it's complex. It's purely damped in this case. And tau is n over t. T is the temperature, only energy scale in the problem. And this n appears because when n becomes infinite, this pole has to move to the origin and you have a delta function. So when n is infinite, this pole is directly at the origin and you have a delta function frequency response, as I showed in previous slides. So the small frequency response is really well captured by the single pole. I'll call this pole D pole, D for Drude, but I don't want to use the word Drude too much because we don't have any disorders, so it's a pretty sensitive word. So let's look at what happens on the holographic side. So we had one pole on the CFT side for this Owen model. On the gravity side, when gamma is positive, I'm showing the sort of three low-lying quasi-normal modes or poles. So this is imaginary frequency, that's real frequency, and that's the real axis. Okay, so they're all in lower half plane by retardedness. And the point is that this D pole reappears, so there's a pole on the imaginary axis. And this guy essentially gives rise to this peak at small frequencies. And the other poles explain the other peaks, essentially. So so knowing this pole structure essentially you can sort of reconstruct the entire function. And if you look at 1 over sigma, because I said there are also zeros of this function, so in this case, the real part of 1 over sigma shows these two poles. So these will be two zeros that will just appear in these holes where they should be, really. And the point is that if you look at the sort of real, well, you don't really see it too well, but there's a dip at small frequencies and a peak, then you saturate. And this looks a lot like the negative gamma response. So there's a sort of a connection between negative gamma and 1 over sigma inverting the connectivity. And this brings me to talk a bit about particle vortex or S-duality. So on the CFT side, this S-duality takes the connectivity 1 over itself. In this holographic prescription, what happens is that this S-duality in the bulk looks like electromagnetic duality for the bulk E1 gauge field. And in particular, when you have gamma equal to 0, so you only have Maxwell action, the self-duality is really the sort of self-S-duality where the Maxwell action is actually Hodge self-dual. So this explains that sigma is equal to 1 over sigma at all frequencies and has to be equal to 1 everywhere in a complex plane. When gamma is finite, you break this self-duality, and then S-duality acts non-trivial in the theory. But it's pretty simple. So morally speaking, S-duality essentially flips the sign of this four-derivative term, gamma. So you have positive gamma, do S-duality, and you essentially have the response at negative gamma.
Is h-bar or h equal to 1?
Oh, the units in this case?
Yeah.
Everything equal to 1.
H-bar and h-bar both equal to 1. The pi, 2 pi is equal to 1.
Oh. This is a unit
of sigma of infinity.
Sigma infinity is the t equals zero connectivity.
That's it. Okay.
So I'm not putting that number in there, but it's
okay.
It's really. But yeah, I mean, as duality, you know, obviously exchanges the poles and zeros of these correlation functions just because of this relation. So then zeros become sort of physical normal modes for the S-dual theory. And sort of the main feature that distinguishes this particle-like versus vortex-like response, in this case it's pretty sharp, is whether you have a pole or a zero on the imaginary axis, just below the origin. So that's sort of like a sharper statement than just saying that you have these wiggles at real frequencies. Okay, something else that we stumbled upon and was also, yes?
So this is like this change in the theory on the bottom, right?
Yeah. Upper half plane.
Are locations of the zeros constrained by decay?
Well, so the dual theory is a CFT, and you expect that to have also all the sort of poles in the lower half plane. Yeah. So in all these things, all the poles and zeros always stay in the lower half plane.
I guess, yeah. Is there a reason, just from the point of view of the original theory, that has to be the case that the zeros are constrained to be in the same half plane?
Well, I mean, if
you.
Well, in some cases, I guess that duality is not even well defined. I mean, if you have generic currents, it's not necessarily clear what S duality means.
The operation itself was defined by Wittgen some time ago. You take a 3D CFT with the U1 triple symmetry, you just gauge the full symmetry and flow to that.
Exactly, with U1 symmetry. But you know, what do you do if you have like SU2 and you want to keep the. Exactly. So.
But then you don't get a spot in the bulk of it.
Yeah.
So the resistivity is a response function, too.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the sort of, if you have like a reasonable field theory, expect by causality that all the poles will be in the lower half plane.
Oh, yes.
The poles become zeros of the S-dual theory, so if it exists, but if it doesn't, yeah, you're right.
Does this procedure always work?
It's an operation on 3CFT with the Yonkel symmetry, which usually.
It's sort of a formal procedure, but.
Yeah.
I mean, for the O2 model, it's, you know, you go from this sort of 5-4 theory to a billion Higgs. So 5-4 plus gauge field. That's like sort of a canonical example here. Okay, so sum rules. This was also discussed by Herzog and company previously. So this is the sum rule that you find in holography, is that if you take a real part of connectivity and subtract this value at infinity, so the sort of ground state value, and integrate all frequencies, you get zero. And okay, well, so this works in holography. Then we looked at the O(n) model in a large n limit, peculiar looking function, but still satisfies that. You can also do the same for like free Dirac fermions, also satisfies it. Obviously, it's very hard to check for any sort of interacting CFT because we just don't know the response function of all frequencies. But you know, let me claim that this could be true. So there's some arguments on the holographic side that rely on Cramer's quantum relation, as you know, all sum rules that we know do. And you can connect this also to the ball gauge invariance of this gauge field dual to the current. So, but generically speaking, we don't have a proof for. We don't have that proof. Do you have a proof? I don't have a proof for that. Okay, we have a quote proof. And so.
So is this true in any dimension?
No. Two dimensions. So you can adapt this. So these guys, Kaminsky, Herzog, Gulot, and Kaminsky have adapted this to different collation functions in different dimensions, as long as they have a classical gravity dual. And you can, so you have to subtract different things essentially. So in three dimensions, the singly growing, like, I don't know, omega squared or omega or something. And, but yeah, you can adapt different sum rules, yeah. Six, three?
Three.
Oh shit. Okay, as dual sum rule, it's a very, okay, let's move on. Small n, so this is, let's, you know, switch gears and talk about actual real world. Not that, yes?
Can you think like A sigma plus B over C sigma plus B?
Well, if you have a theta term, maybe you can look at these things. But yeah, this is like only the S part of the SL2Z, just for simplicity. But generically, people have discussed this. Okay, so let me just go a bit faster in this. So we're going to compare these holographic results with very recent quantum Monte Carlo data on the Bose-Hubbard model. And actually, it's not a Bose-Hubbard, it's this 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum rotor model, which is believed to have a critical point in the same universality class. The big problem there is that finite temperature calculation happens in imaginary time, and the whole mystery is how to continue from the imaginary axis response to the real axis response to get the retarded response function. And that's, you know, not controlled. So, yes, that's what I just said. And the idea will be to sort of use holography to do that procedure somehow. So this is very recent data from a few days ago by Eric Sorensen. Pretty large system sizes. So I was told that a lot of CPU years were burned on these on this data. So it's very, very nice data, but you know, without any non-perturbative calculation, we don't really have much insight about this generic functional form. Well, sure, we'll saturate at infinity, but we don't really know to what value and how. So the idea is to fit that to a holography. So holography, you have the entire complex plane. So you know, just look at the response on the imaginary axis, and that's a green curve. And that fit corresponds to gamma equal to 0.07, which is less than a bound from holography. And I have rescaled something, rescaled the frequency dependence. But in contrast, this dashed line is this negative gamma. So that's the S-dual value if you want. And obviously that doesn't fit. Obviously this thing is going up. So let me conclude from this that the Bose-Hubbard model and the quantum rotor model has a particle-like response. In particular, it will have this quasi-normal mode in the imaginary axis, which is a pole in this case, not a zero. And also the sort of ratio of the DC connectivity to the one at infinity, so this to this, agrees with naive holographic bounds, although you know there's not too much to expect from that. And there's a tilde here, because there's infamous long-time tails that sort of would change what I mean by DC connectivity, but yeah, let me not talk about this now. So the idea is that we have this fit on the imaginary axis, and holography is this full complex function, well, the real function, but in complex plane. So let's just use that's evaluated on the real axis. And so that's the continuation that we get for this imaginary time Monte Carlo data. And that looks pretty reasonable. And one of the main points is that I think it looks much better than any other continuation procedures. For example, Padé analysis, which implies fitting this to a meromorphic function with a finite number of poles and zeros, doesn't do really well because this function actually has an infinite number of poles and zeros. So intrinsically, if you only keep like 3 or 4 poles, you're bound to sort of not capture this thing very well. And you have like sort of fun peaks and you know crazy stuff that I don't expect to happen. So let me claim that this holographic continuation is the best procedure at this point in time to analyze this data. If you have a better one, that's even greater. Okay, so let me conclude. I have time to conclude. All right, so we talked about this.
I give you extra time. Oh, I'm not biased.
All right, so we looked at this complex, well, this connectivity, we look at this in the complex plane, and we found that there's a bunch of poles and zeros, which are called the quasi-normal modes, and these actually have sort of very sharp differences in different regimes. And also, we have looked at some rules, which constrain quite a bit these correlation functions. And if you do numerics or experiments and measure that function, you can always check the sum rule. If it doesn't satisfy the sum rule, then we have to scratch our head a bit more, but it's at least something to chew on. And if you can prove it in generality, that would be pretty interesting. And the main point at the end was to use ADS-CFT to, you know, very concretely interpret QMC data. And then we make sharp statements or tentative sharp statements about the Bose-Hubbard model. So yeah, that's a concrete, quote unquote, application of ADS-CFT. And let me give you some outlook, so 3 points. So one can look at different correlation functions. So this was current-current, but you can look at order parameter, or order parameter squared. You can also do more simulations, so using different algorithms. Also using different models, so O3 model, or doing the S-dual version of the Bose-Hubbard, the abelian Higgs. So there are some algorithms out there in the lattice gauge theory literature. And see if you can get the sort of vortex-like response. And let me whisper a word about experiments. So cold atoms might be a venue to test these things in some nearby future, because they have realized the mod transition in two dimensions in optical lattices. Small system sizes, so it's hard to really probe universal scaling functions, and that's what we want, but in principle, it's a scaling problem, just like quantum computing, so let's use that as a hope, and also, yeah, numerical experiments. So yeah, let me thank you on this.
Can you show that numerical data are doing?
You're going to point some.
No, I'm just. Yeah.
No fit. This is a raw thing, yeah.
I see. So the scale.
Yeah, that's omega over.
So this is real frequency. It's after the analytic.
No, this is so this is your complex frequency plane. And these are. Well, let me not. These are points.
By construction, you cannot go below 2 pi.
Yeah.
Right. So it's the lowest possible frequency.
Yeah. I mean, that's unfortunately the big.
Yeah.
Right.
That's why we're doing ADS-CFT.
No. So let's try to understand what she's fitting to. So this imaginary frequency, you go to the lowest possible frequency. So that data you can get.
Yeah.
And then you're fitting an ADS calculation. And then taking the imaginary frequency, taking the Matsubara correlation function.
Yeah, so you take the holographic expression at imaginary frequencies, mm-hmm. and you have this fitting parameter, and there's also an alpha that needs to be there, because otherwise the scale doesn't match. But so there's two parameters essentially in this fit.
Ratio of sigma 0 to sigma of infinity is independent of the alpha.
Yeah, alpha is just a rescaling. So this dictates, so the ratio, let me put a tilde again because there's really a caveat.
Sigma 0 is what then? Is it the
is that
real? It's not real frequency going to be. It's 0 Matsuba frequency.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So look at the actual full complex function. They meet at a regular point of the function. So it's a meromorphic function, and this has only these poles in the lower half plane. So real axis and upwards is all analytic. So you could have a branch cut in the origin, actually. That's a long time tail, and holography suppresses these long time tails. So does quantum Boltzmann approaches. But if you just do a classical hydrodynamic argument, you expect, well, here I'm talking about this, so let me do it. So sigma, as you go to really small frequencies, much less in temperature, so T is your effective cutoff scale for your hydro theory. It's the only scale in theory. So this will have a log divergence. So some constant, well, let me just drop all constants. So there's a branch point, generically, at the origin.
Hey, Aditya, you have last one.
Maybe in the radius CFT analysis, how much of Hubbard model input is there?
Zero. Yeah, no, because I mean, it's I mean, so look. So I mean, on the area CFT.
The only link is Subir.
I mean, is there another link I'm missing?
The symmetry is the
Well, I mean, look, but that's, you know, not generic to the Bose-Hubbard model. It's just any CFT.
Yeah.
All right. But Bose-Hubbard model, yeah, no. It's actually, when you get... Okay, what? Yeah, yeah.
Well, so the CFT, the gravitation is some general theory for a CFT with a conserved U1 current. And associated with that general theory, there's a parameter gamma, which you can also define formally in the CFT. The gamma is a number associated with every CFT, defined precisely. And both on the CFT side and the gravity side, you get the same bound. Gamma has to be less than 1/12. So we have computed some 1/n expansion, the value of gamma, from the CFT. And, you know, and we get it very close to this bound, but in the frequency, it's exactly the bound. So the value of gamma that we get out from the fit, and the value of gamma we get from it, explicit computations on the field theory are very close to each other.
But generically, you expect other higher order terms to appear, and even quantum gravity. And
So
the O2 model is not dual to any simple classical gravity, and that's the whole point. But you expect that some universal properties might be captured. And it seems that some of them are, actually. But there is some links. Yeah, this gamma, you can compute it from the TJJ collator.
Can you actually compute
the quantum Monte Carlo?
We hope to do that.
Eric, because it's a ground state property, so it's hard, but in principle, I think you can compute it, right? So the correlation function of a stress energy tensor with two currents. Anything is possible.
The one advantage of that is it doesn't involve any analytic continuity. It can be done exactly. It can be done at
that's a good test ground.
That's a ground state property. No thermal average in this.
Do you have a similar sum rule for thermal connectivity?
So the sum rule actually was for finite temperature connectivity. Thermal, kappa over T. Kappa, yeah.
The
CFT
probably
is.
So these guys, Herzog and company, have looked at TT correlation functions. And there are some rules for those. Stress.
Yeah, but in the CFT limit, it's of course infinity.
Yeah, so you need
it. But coming from middle event.
Yeah. I don't know if, yeah.
Lunch,
yes.
Do you have any insight as to what kind of models do they give the vortex like this?
Well, yeah, so abelian Higgs.
Not abelian, n component. Well, more scalar.
I guess it's true from your work that it's.
Well, I mean, abelian Higgs is the same theory as the O2 model. You have to have.
No, but the dual connectivity will be 1/ the original one.
Yeah.
But it's the same theory, but it's...
Right. There is a second conductivity in the high part.
Exactly, in that sense. that's my answer is that if you S-dualize and you look at the sort of topological current in the particle or in the abelian Higgs, that would give you that vortex-like response. And Subir and Debanjan have this O-N model with fermions and scalars coupled to gauge field, and this reproduces a whole range of gammas. So depending on the matter content, you can have different values of gamma. So you can go from vortex to particle-like. So they have an actual large N.
The vortex is a real particle. Long interacting.
Yeah. How crazy? I think it's pretty crazy. Well, because it's hard to, so these bosons don't have charge. I mean, you have to tilt the lattice somehow. They don't have like a physical electric charge. So you apply some sort of gradient, not like that. You apply some B field. So you tilt effectively. And you need a large system size to observe scaling, actually, right? And these have pretty small system sizes, like hundreds of bosons.
I'll talk about some of the latest experiments in the 2D boson more in this afternoon.
So maybe it's getting better, but the ones that are published, it's still pretty small. Well, 100 bosons is...
Let's thank bosons.